I can't tell you how excited I am to see you all here. I mean, they stole our chairs to go hear Dale, and I can't blame them. What a great lectureship. I started looking at the classrooms coming down the hallway here, and you've got Everett Ferguson, Mr. Church History, and next door you've got Jack P. Lewis, I mean, the Bible scholar. Across the way, Dale Manor, with biblical archaeology. So I am really grateful. I understand that you couldn't find seats in Dale's class and you came here, but I'm grateful anyway, and I hope we'll take advantage of this time. This class is about adventure. I want you to think about that for a minute. Adventure. Maybe it takes you back to your childhood, climbing that tree, or going out into the woods, or swimming in the creek, or swimming out to the raft, which is impossibly far. You'll drown before you get there, but you did it anyway. Do you remember what it was like to be a kid and have adventures? But somewhere along the way, we grew up, and we became reasonable, and we began working our 9-to-5 jobs and raising our families and all these things. And the adventures came at a distance. Maybe we lived them vicariously through books or watching the Discovery Channel, you know. But adventures kind of went away. And we find ourselves on the sideline. And I found many Christians, frankly, feel that they're bored. Something is missing, that they're empty inside. And that is not the life that Jesus promised. Jesus in John chapter 10, verse 10, said that I have come that they may have life and what? Have it abundantly. He didn't say we'll have life when you die, although that's one of the benefits. We've got a great retirement program. But life with a capital L begins right now. Now, I've been very, very fortunate to live an adventurous life, and I'll tell you some stories about that as we go along. But I'm mostly interested in your adventure, about finding that thing that fires you up again, and you become excited about the adventure that we call Christianity. I'd help you understand that. Many years ago, I was climbing in Colorado. I've been an avid mountaineer. I've led expeditions around the world. I was a professional mountain guide in Bavaria, and I've done a lot of climbs here in the United States. And we were climbing Mount Elbert. Now, Mount Elbert isn't that great a mountain. Okay, it's the tallest one in Colorado, so you get credit for that, right? It's taller than Mount Rainier. We'll talk about that, how you measure it. But we're on the backside of Mount Elbert, and it had been one of those foggy, kind of rainy mornings. You know, we got up early because it was a long way to the summit, and we began walking, and we got through the timberline, and we got above the timberline and up in the big boulders and then in the scree fields. And as we get out there, the clouds are beginning to part. The fog is beginning to burn off. And those old silver miners, they're amazing. They would go high to find silver. And so we found the tailings of an old mine and the tracks that, well, the entrance to the mine shaft had collapsed, but the old tracks were still there, and they hung out over space. And so we sat there on the end of this dump, and we looked out over the valley as the clouds began to open up. And all of a sudden, from here to the wall, there's the biggest bird I have seen in my entire life. A beautiful golden eagle is sitting there, and he is not bothered by us one little bit. He just kind of looks over his shoulder and goes, huh. And then he falls. Doesn't begin flapping his wings like a duck trying to get up. He just kind of falls out over the valley and unfolds these magnificent wings. And he soars right in front of us. Those wings, you can see the wing tips wiggling to catch every breath of air. And he looks right at me as if to say, huh. And he soars by. It took your breath away. We had to sit there for at least 5 minutes just to go, wow, what an encounter. Now, I'd like you to imagine this same magnificent, beautiful incredible golden eagle down in the farmyard, down there with the chickens. And he's walking around pecking and scratching at the earth. Can you think of anything more pathetic than a golden eagle who thinks he's a chicken? I can. And it's a Christian who doesn't realize he's a Christian. And all of the power and the abundance and the adventures that God has in store for us. My meemaw, grandma, was a great one with sayings. And she used to say, sitting in a hen house no more makes you a chicken than sitting in a church makes you a Christian. We got to get up. We got to spread our wings. We've got to begin the adventure. Okay, now here's the test. I'm an old university professor, so I have to give a test. Did you bring your Bible this morning? It's a Bible lectureship. Let's open up our Bibles to the Gospel of John chapter 1. Now this is, John chapter 1 and chapter 2 are so vivid. The Apostle John, writing at Ephesus many, many years later, can still remember the first time that he met Jesus. John was a disciple of John the Baptist, and he's there with his best friend Andrew, and he hears Jesus point to Jesus. And then John and Andrew go, and they're kind of following Jesus. Have you seen a celebrity? You know, like Alan last night. Wasn't he great? What an incredible experience we're having, and it's just beginning. And did you stand in line to meet him afterwards? Okay, I did. I had to have my picture taken. My whole congregation back in San Diego at Canyon View said, Duck Dynasty, really? They're big fans. I said, you got to get a picture with Alan. And, okay, I'll do that. And he was so gracious and, you know, just a kind gentleman. So we got the picture. Well, maybe you've seen somebody famous. Maybe you were in Branson or on vacation and you see somebody and you'd really like to meet them, but you're not quite sure how you go about doing it or what you're going to say. Have you done that before? And so here we've got John and Andrew, and they're following behind Jesus, and they're talking, well, what are we going to say to him? How are we doing it? And Jesus knows they're back there. And he turns, and there's that really awkward moment when Jesus looks into their eyes, and they look at Jesus, and it's kind of like, what do we say next? And so they say, Rabbi, where are you staying? What kind of question? You know? And Jesus just smiles and invites them to come. John, all those years later, remembers the hour that he first talked with Jesus. Now the story continues, and Jesus calls Philip. And then Philip is so excited that he goes and he finds Nathanael, right? Nathanael Bartholomew. In the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, he's called Bartholomew, Bar meaning son of Ptolemy. So Nathanael is his first name, Nathanael Bartholomew. And Philip, we've heard this sermon how many times, as Philip says, I found the Messiah. And Nathanael goes, yeah, all right. Where's he from? Nazareth. Nazareth. Great conversation. Philip handles it properly. He says, just come see for yourself. I can't explain it. Just come see for yourself. And he introduces him to Jesus. Now, do you remember what happens next? Have your Bible open. John chapter 1, beginning in verse 47. John chapter 1, verse 47. When Jesus saw Nathanael approaching, he said of him, here's a true Israelite in whom there is nothing false. How should we pronounce verse 48? You know, I told you before, I'm an old-time radio announcer. I was a newscaster for National Public Radio and had a radio program while I was in Korea. And so how do you give the inflection in verse 48? Does Nathanael say, well, how do you know me? Or does he ask it suspiciously, how do you know me? Put it in your mind. And then what's Jesus' response? Jesus answered, I saw you while you were still under the fig tree before Philip called you. Now look at Nathanael's response. Then Nathanael declared, Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel. What is it about seeing him under a fig tree that makes him believe suddenly that the guy from Nazareth that he was despising a minute ago is the Messiah. Well, many scholars say, and if you've seen fig trees, do they have fig trees here in Arkansas? You know, this is my first time to Harding, and but in California we have fig trees, and they've got great big leaves, big three-lobed leaves. And so I guess it would make a good apron for Adam and Eve, although kind of scratchy, I suspect. But a fig tree grows like a weeping willow. And that is that the leaves come out, the branches come out, and they go right down to the ground. And as a little kid, do you remember playing underneath a weeping willow? It could kind of be your house. You part the curtain and you go inside and you've got your own room. Well, likewise, fig trees, in a day when everybody sleeps in the same room and the houses were kind of small, to go to the fig tree, that was your special place. It was your quiet place. And it's the place where Philip, or rather where Nathanael, would have had his quiet time with God. And so when Jesus says, "I saw you under the fig tree," Jesus had heard Nathanael's prayer. It impressed him. But what our focus this morning is on the next verse, verse 50. "You believe because I told you, I saw you under the fig tree? You shall see greater things than that." Now that's the verse I'd like you to underline. "You shall see greater things than that." Now this happens way down in the Jordan, not far from Jericho probably, and they spend the next 2 days walking up to Cana. What things did Nathanael see because he left it all to follow Jesus? Jesus walking on water. Jesus healing the sick. He probably had a fish or two out of that basket when Jesus multiplied the loaves and fishes. Think of all the things that he saw. And then when Jesus went back to heaven, when Nathanael becomes the preacher, the evangelist, we don't have a book of Acts that describes what Philip and Nathanael did. They're traditions. I don't know how much credit we can give those traditions. But Jesus promised Nathanael an adventurous life. Now, I mentioned before, when we were kids, we were great adventurers. You know, we could pretend we would be explorers, mountain climbers, sail the seven seas, fight pirates or Indians or bad guys. We had all those dreams and all those adventures, but we kind of grew up. And now adventures are the kind of things that we fantasize about in a book, or that we live vicariously. For example, anybody here like football? Got a few? Okay, there. All right. If I can't play, I'm not interested. You know, I'm kind of that way. But think about it. All the fans afterwards say, "We won." Well, what did you do? You sat in the bleacher, drinking beer and eating a hot dog. You know, how did you help them win? But we identify vicariously. That's not the life that we are called to as Christians. It's not a life at a distance, but we are called into the adventure. But I like what Yvonne Chouinard. Yvonne Chouinard is a famous American mountaineer. He's also the founder of Patagonia Clothing. Those of you who have Patagonia coats and shirts and things. Yvonne Chouinard. Chouinard has a great saying. He says, it's not an adventure until something goes wrong. Isn't that true? You know, isn't that true? Of course, my wife says, every time we untie from the dock, John, it's another adventure. You know, here we go again. You know, it's like I was talking at breakfast. What do you remember from your wedding? It's not the things that went right. It's the things that went wrong. Right? The flower girl did this. Uncle Benny got hit by a golf ball. You know, you remember the things that went wrong. As I was getting ready to preach my first wedding, that was a long time ago. Next year I will have been preaching for 40 years. And way back in the ancient days, weddings were big events. They were very, very formal. I don't know how it is in Arkansas. In California now, basically anybody can do a wedding. Hey, let's jump out of an airplane and get married on the way down. You know, it could be a very short wedding. But Anybody can do weddings, but in those days, you know, it was very formal. The groom's people sat on this side. The bride's people sat on this side. Stand up, sit down, all the stuff. And I was so nervous. So I went to the oldest preacher that I knew, Maurice Meredith. And Maurice was in his mid-80s at the time, always had a twinkle in his eye, you know, like there's something he knows that you don't know. And I was going over the ceremony with Maurice and so forth. And he said, now, John, when you get to the part where it's time to exchange the rings, if nothing has gone wrong, drop the ring. I said, drop the ring? Why? He says, otherwise they won't have anything to remember. And isn't that true? I tell that story before every wedding. And I go, if something happens, don't worry. We're not making mistakes. We're making memories. How many of you saw or maybe read the book? People used to do that. Read the book, The Hobbit by J.R.R. Tolkien. Yeah. And there's a wonderful scene as Gandalf the Wizard meets Bilbo Baggins. Now, let me just read part of this for you. All that the unsuspecting Bilbo saw that morning was an old man with a staff. He had a tall, pointed blue hat, a long gray coat, a silver scarf over which his long white beard hung down below his waist, and immense black boots. "Good morning," said Bilbo, and he meant it. The sun was shining and the grass was very green, but Gandalf looked at him from under long, bushy eyebrows that stuck out further than the brim of his shady hat. "What do you mean?" he said. "Do you wish me a good morning, or mean that it is a good morning, whether I want it or not? Or do you feel good this morning, or is that it's a good morning to be good on?" "All of them at once," said Bilbo. "And a very fine morning for a pipe of tobacco, out of doors into the bargain. If you have a pipe about you, sit down and have a fill of mine. There's no hurry. We have all the day before us." Then Bilbo sat down on a seat by his door, crossed his legs, and blew out beautiful gray rings of smoke that sailed up into the air without breaking and floated away over the hill. "Very pretty," said Gandalf. "But I have no time to blow smoke rings this morning. I'm looking for someone to share in an adventure that I am arranging, and it's very difficult to find anyone." "I should think so in these parts. We are plain quiet folk and have no use for adventures. Nasty, disturbing, uncomfortable things make you late for dinner." "I can't think what anybody sees in them," said our Mr. Baggins, and stuck one thumb behind his braces and blew out another even bigger smoke ring. Nasty, uncomfortable, disturbing things. So it is that Christians oftentimes get comfortable in our ways. But think about it. We sit in this thing called a pew. You ever wonder about that? You know, we insulate and isolate ourselves. A few years ago, I attended the first Congress on Biblical Exposition. It was an interdenominational effort to get back to the Bible. That sounded pretty restoration to me. And so I wanted to be a part of it. And I went to Houston, Texas, to the Second Baptist Church. Now, they didn't call themselves Second Baptist. It was the first church of the excitement. And it was an amazing mega church. You didn't just park in the parking lot. They had it marked off like Disneyland. You parked at Jericho or over at Ephesus this morning and so forth. And they were very concerned that we not be contaminated by the world around us. And so in their facility, they also had a Christian gym or workout center. And they had cassette tapes. Anybody remember cassette tapes? They had cassette tapes that you could listen to while you worked out of the preacher preaching. I cannot imagine anything worse than somebody trying to work out listening to my sermons unless it raises your blood pressure, which I've done occasionally. All right. But they also had an indoor Christian archery range, so you didn't have to go to those pagan archery range in Houston, Texas. They had a bowling alley, so our kids wouldn't have to go to those pagan bowling alleys. But the thing that I loved the most was they had their own cafeteria. So you didn't have to go and share it with other people. You want to know the name? The Garden of Eden. Isn't that terrible? Isn't that terrible? All right, don't want to be isolated. Now, it gets worse because, remember, ladies, a few years ago, Jazzercise was the big thing. Everybody wanted to work out. And actually, there's a company in San Diego, not far from where I live, that produces records for Christian jazzercise. It's called Believer Size. And their slogan, I love their slogan, reduce your thighs with Believer Size. All right, yeah, you don't have to listen to those pagan songs. Well, we'll go on to something else. We need to have adventures. That is the life that God has called us to. But there's a problem, because adventures are not easy things. They challenge us in a way that can be very disturbing. It brings us right to the edge and maybe a bit beyond our comfort level. But that's part of the excitement of the adventure. There's a wonderful reading called On the Road of Life. Let me just share it with you. At first, I saw God as my observer, my judge, keeping track of things I did wrong, so that to know whether I merited heaven or hell when I died. He was out there, sort of like a president. I recognized this picture when I saw it, but I didn't really know him. But later on, when I met Christ, it seemed as though life were rather like a bike ride. But it was a tandem bike, and I noticed that Christ was in back helping me pedal. I don't know just when it was that he suggested we trade places, but life has not been the same since. When I had control, I knew the way. It was rather boring, but predictable. It was the shortest distance between two points. But when he took the lead, he knew delightful long cuts, up mountains and through rocky places, at breakneck speeds. It was all I could do to hang on. Even though it looked like madness, he said, pedal. I worried and was anxious and asked, where are you taking me? He laughed and didn't answer. And I started to learn to trust. I forgot my boring life and entered into the adventure. And when I'd say, I'm scared, he'd lean back and touch my hand. He took me to people with gifts that I needed, gifts of healing, acceptance, and joy. They gave me gifts to take on my journey, mine and the Lord's. And we were off again. He said, give the gifts away. They're extra baggage, too much weight. So I did, to the people we met, and I found that in giving I received, and still our burden was light. I did not trust him at first, in control of my life. I thought he'd wreck it, but he knows bike secrets, knows how to make it bend, to take sharp corners, knows how to jump to clear high rocks, knows how to fly to shorten scary passages, and I am learning to shut up and pedal in the strangest places, and I'm beginning to enjoy the view and the cool breeze in my face with my constant, delightful companion, Jesus Christ. And when I'm sure I just can't do any more, he just smiles and says, pedal. We are on the adventurous life. You're on the adventurous life. And some of you are going, yeah, fine. That's great for a Californian. I mean, California's the land of fruits and nuts. Right? Okay. And yeah, John, you can go out and climb frozen waterfalls if you want. Or you can go out and kayak class 4 rapids. Or you can take off with your wife and sail over the ocean blue and venture away. That's nice. I'll read your book. Shameless plug for my book at this point. All right. You can read about all that. But what about me? What about my life? Well, we're going to come to that. Let's open our Bibles to our passage for the next three classes. It's from Hebrews chapter 12. And this really is our guide to the adventurous life. How do we begin? What's it like? Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 through 3. Very familiar passage, but I'll be honest with you, the more you look at this passage, the deeper you dig, the more that you discover. I've been preaching this. This is my stand. You know how preachers have a go-to passage? They're invited to go and preach someplace, and you always have one tucked away in your Bible. This is my tucked away sermon. And still, after all the years, I mean, I've preached it all over Korea and North America and Europe, and just this past week in going over the text again to come here, I discovered some new things. I'll share it with you. So let's read our passage, and then we'll focus on verse 1 for this hour. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. Let's focus now on verse 1. Therefore, that points us back to chapter 11, the witnesses that are there from the Old Testament. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses. How do you picture that? My congregation at Canyon View is so tired of telling them to use their sanctified imaginations. How do you see this? We're surrounded by a cloud of witnesses. It's kind of like there's a stadium, and we are there in the stadium, and they're all watching us. Now, how are they watching us? Now, I know in a crowd like this, there are some of you who are taking notes for the heresy trial, right? You know, there are the critics going, you won't believe what they said at the Harding Lectureship this year. They had this guy from California, nuttier than a fruitcake, and writing these things. Is that how you see the witnesses, that they're all watching to see if we're going to make a mistake, if we're going to do something wrong? I can't take it. Do you get test anxiety? You know, everybody's watching. Or are the witnesses, and think about the witnesses, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, the judges from the Old Testament, they're watching. And they're not watching to criticize us. Why, in my day, I remember. They're watching because they feel with us. They're pulling for us. It's like watching your child competing for the first time. Any of you been to watch the kids play, what's that baseball game? T-ball. If there was ever a groaner sport, it's T-ball. They put the ball on the tee and they miss. But they keep at it. And we want them to hit. We want them to succeed. We're pulling for them. These witnesses, think about it. These witnesses are watching. They're saying, I've been there. I know what it's like. They are pulling for us to succeed. There is a crowd that is cheering us on. Now, let us throw off everything that hinders. I have a daughter that lives in Brighton, England. I don't understand it. She fell in love with an Englishman, and now she's got two beautiful grandkids. I keep trying to get her to send the grandkids over here, and she can stay in England. But she's marvelous, and I'm very proud of Heather. She decided that she was going to lose weight. She lost 60 pounds and then ran a marathon. Imagine running a marathon. Anybody here run a marathon? I hope so. You know, well, anyway, if I was going to run a marathon, that's what, 26 miles and some change? 26 miles. Can you imagine walking 26 miles? Much. If I was going to run a marathon, I thinking about it, what would you take? I might get hungry. I'm hungry right now, and I had a nice big breakfast. You know, what would you take? I'd put some sandwiches in my backpack. I might get thirsty, add a canteen. It might rain, better include an umbrella, probably a couple changes of socks, you know, add it all. And what, you end up carrying a backpack? What do the marathoners wear? Precious little. You know, they're traveling light. They get rid of anything that might possibly slow them down. We are on a marathon. We're on the Christian race, and we need to lay aside anything that is going to slow us down, anything that's going to keep us from our goal. Now, a few years ago, I came back from Korea, and I went to work for a university in Phoenix. I won't tell you which university in Phoenix I was working for, but it has University and Phoenix in the name. And It was a big change going from a Christian university to a university that is traded on the New York Stock Exchange. It gives you some idea what the focus of the university was. I was miserable. It was the worst job I've had in my life. It was terrible. I was so unhappy. If it wasn't for the work I was doing for NPR, life would have been awful. And so one morning, my wife leaned across the breakfast table, and she said, "John, the last of the kids has left home. What do you say we sell the house and give away everything that we own and buy that sailboat that we've always dreamed about?" I went, "Yeah, honey, you do that, I've got to go to work." I came home, there's a for sale sign in the front yard. It sold the next day. Whoa, you got to love a woman like that, right? All right. Well, we began an adventure. We gave away everything we owned. First, we thought about having a garage sale. You know, the ultimate garage sale. Nothing held back. But then you think about it. Here's that leather couch that you worked so hard for, that you saved for, and you've got it there in the front yard. Somebody pulls up in a pickup truck, says, "I'll give you $25 for that sofa." We thought, no, it'll be a lot more fun just to give it all away. You know, people said, "I really like that picture. Terrific. It's yours." We had so much fun. It was wonderful. We gave it all away, and we moved on board a beautiful old sailboat. Santa Teresa's 16 tons of mahogany, built in 1969. People ask me, "What are you going to do this weekend, John? Are you going sailing?" "No, I'm sanding and varnishing." You know, but Teresa has taken us on some grand adventures. But to go on an adventure, you got to let it go. You need to strip away anything that's going to slow you down. You know, sojourners, you got to leave it all behind. You can't put it in that rig, can you? See, I used the right word. It's a rig, isn't it? It's not a truck. It's not a camper. It's a rig. And you have to leave it all behind. Likewise, on the Christian life, we leave it all behind. We live life on the edge. We take a risk. It is an adventure. But that's not all. What else does the Hebrew author say? He says, "Throw off the sin that so easily entangles." Now, the picture is a great picture. Use that sanctified imagination. We're getting ready for the race, and we get down on our mark. But you forgot to take your sweats off. And the gun goes, and you take that first step, and your sweatpants drop down around your ankles, and you are trying to run with the sweatpants around there, and it's a disaster. Oh, did I just unplug? The rest of this program will be continued on tape 2. All right. Well, sin is that way. Now think about your heroes in the Bible. There are some great men and women. One I absolutely hate, David. Why? David made every mistake that we can imagine. It was adultery. It was murder. All of these terrible, terrible things. But he learned. He learned and didn't do it again. For me, I tend to get stuck on the same sin. It's like somebody nailed my foot to the floor and I'm running in circles. That is an entangling sin. Now, there are a lot of sins that are out there. I have never been tempted to shoot up heroin. There's no appeal there for me. I know it is a problem for some people. Maybe it is for you. But I'm afraid of needles, which is a terrible thing when you're diabetic, to be afraid of needles. But I couldn't do it. On the other hand, I have an entangling sin, and so do you. That same temptation, that weakness, and Satan knows what it is. Now, if Satan knows what it is, and we know what it is, we need to be prepared. Because when temptation comes, that's not when we, you know, I'll pull out my Strong's Analytical or my Young's Complete Concordance and find verses that will help me. It has to be written on the heart. We have to be ready. We've got to get rid of the entangling sins and be strong. What else? Let us run with perseverance. Now, circle the word perseverance. You'll find it in verses 1, 2, and 3. It might be disguised. They might call it endurance, or perseverance, or patience. There are two words in the New Testament that are translated by patience. One of them is macrothumia. Macro is big. Thumia is like thermometer. Macrothumia means long suffering in the King James. I love that. It's a great translation of the word. And there are some times, there are some things that happen in our life when all God expects us to do is hang on. You come to the end of the rope, hang on. But that's not the word that's used here. The word here is my favorite word. And since my undergraduate degree is in Greek, I have to use a Greek word in every sermon, right? It's hupomone. That we have the verb form a little bit later on. Endurance. Now, what is endurance? The best way that I can describe this, there's a tiny flower. Now, the mountains are full of beautiful flowers. But there's one flower that stands out above all the rest. You're from Colorado, you know the one I'm talking about. You get up above the timberline. And up there, where nothing would be expected to grow. I mean, at 14,000 feet, you've got very little oxygen. It's buried under snow 9 months out of the year, and then when the sun is shining down, there's no water. It is the worst possible growing conditions for a plant. And yet, there's a little tiny flower there called the mountain forget-me-not. You have to get down on your hands and knees to see it. It's no bigger than your thumbnail. The center of the flower is the most vivid, vibrant, beautiful yellow that you can ever imagine. It is so bright that it would hurt your eyes were it not for the iridescent purple petals that surround it. It's a magnificent flower. But I want you to think about what this flower has to deal with. The hardship, the ice, the snow, the lack of air, the direct exposure to the sun, it not only endures, I think about the orange and yellow lichens that grow on the rocks up there, they endure, but the mountain forget-me-not doesn't just endure, that's macrothumia, it thrives. It is given the worst and makes the best out of it. That's the Christian life. An adventure is a painful thing. You are going to get bruised. You're going to be hungry. You're going to get frostbite, sunburn, wind, whatever. You know? But it's worth the adventure. Christians are at their best when life is at its worst. When things go bad, and it's life. You can't protect yourself. It's life. And when things go bad, that's when Christians are at their worst, or at their best. let's correct that edit in the tape for later on. Christians are at their best. Now, we run with perseverance. It's the mountain forget-me-not. We run the course that's set out for us. If you were going to run a race this afternoon, what race would it be? I think I'd like the 2-yard dash. That sounds good to me. You know, it's not our own choosing. My little brother has a saying. I dearly love it. It says, "If you want to make God laugh, if you want to make God laugh." Make a plan, right? A lot of us think that, you know, I'll sock so much of my salary away into an IRA and so forth, and I'll pay off this and have all of these things, and I'll make sure to always wear a hat when I go outside. And you know what? Does anybody know what the mortality rate for human beings is? 100%. We're all going to die, right? And so God is the one who sets the course out before us. It is our job to run the race that God sets before us. And we run that race with endurance. Okay, let's take a look at verse 2. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus. That means that we're not just aware of him on the peripheral, but we fix our attention on Christ. We think about Jesus. He is our inspiration. He is our hero. Who were your heroes growing up? Okay, this is the participation part of the class. This is the part where I need to see everybody's still awake. All right, who were your heroes? Were they from the comic books? Television? Name some of the heroes. It's okay. Tarzan. Oh, yeah. That's great, man. He's living in the trees, you know, and he doesn't have to comb his hair. He goes swimming a lot with crocodiles. That's a tough, adventurous guy. He's got a beautiful wife, you know, and three lovely kids. That Tarzan was a great hero. Who else? Superman?
Willie Mays.
Willie Mays, sports hero. All right. Inspirational story. There are some great ones. We could list all of them, whether you're the cowboy guy, you know, with Roy Rogers and, you know, his six shooters. He had a great voice and had such great shirts, you know. Or we could look at Superman and the other heroes that are out there, or Sergeant Rock and his screaming fury, whatever it was. But I had other heroes. Ernest Shackleton. Ernest Shackleton set out to be the first person to lead an expedition to walk across the South Pole, across Antarctica, from one side to the other. Didn't even make it. They were frozen in the ice. Sir Ernest Shackleton and his men. The ship was crushed by the ice. 2 years. But his men carried their boats across the ice floes, and eventually he made the most incredible voyage, 600 miles across the Southern Ocean, in a 21-foot lifeboat without GPS. Incredible story, and he lost no one. No one died on that disaster. What an incredible leader. Or Sir... the list goes on and on and on. Think about it. But for a Christian, our hero is Jesus. And we fix our eyes on Jesus. We fix our attention on Jesus. We're going to come back to that in a minute. William, help me watch the time. What do we have here?
Just 15 more minutes.
How many?
15 more minutes.
15 more minutes?
Probably
5 more minutes, okay, because you want a break, right? I'm a firm believer that the brain cannot absorb what the seat cannot endure. Do I get an amen at least for that one? All right. Well, we fix our eyes on Jesus. He is the author and perfecter of our faith. Circle the word author. I don't think that's a very good translation. He's the author of our salvation. That sounds like it was written by a theologian. You know, he worked out a carefully conceived plan, and so the plan is God's. The word author there literally means he began it. He began it. That's not even a good word for it. Probably the best word that I could find for author would be pioneer. Pioneer. A pioneer is the one who goes first. Okay. Do you remember when you were 11 years old and you went to scout camp? Okay, I know some of you didn't go to scout camp, but every scout camp that I've ever been to, there's a pond, a place for swimming, and there's the cliff. It's impossibly high. You're 11 years old. It looks like it reaches up to the stars, and everybody's standing on top of the cliff. And the little boys are looking, I bet if you jump off this cliff, you'll die. No, No, you won't die. Yeah, you'll die. No, you won't die. Then you jump off. No, you jump off. I double dog dare you to jump off this cliff. Oh, man. A double dog dare? This is it. You walk up to the very edge, and you look down. Your life passes before your eyes. Doesn't take very long. You're only 11 years old. And then everybody's watching, trying to figure out how they're going to explain to the scoutmaster that Johnny is dead. You know, and everyone is watching with bated breath, and you go, I got to do it. And you got to watch my microphone cord here. I got to do it. And you take it, and you jump. Ah! Oof! And then he comes back up out of the water. And he's alive. It's incredible. It's a miracle. It's amazing. Hey, it could be fun, right? What happens next? Somebody goes first to prove that it can be done. And then what happens? Everybody follows. Everybody follows. Jesus is the pioneer. We could look at life and go, life is so hard. So many unexpected things. We talked about Ebola earlier. The Democrats could win the election. You know, is Arkansas a Democratic state? I'm from California, and everybody there, I think, is Republican or something like that. You know, life is full of uncertainties. And we could look at life and go, what God is asking of us is impossible. It's a terrible life. But Jesus went first and showed us that it can be done. Jesus is the pioneer. But wait, he's not just the pioneer. He is also, circle the second word there, he's the perfecter of our faith. Put a little star and a note at the bottom of your Bible. This is the only place this word appears in the Bible. In fact, it's the only place it appears before the book of Hebrews. This is the only place. He's the perfecter of our faith. We might think that, yeah, he finishes things for us. The word perfecter here means, there's a wonderful article in the Journal of Biblical Literature that says it nothing can be added to it. That is, this is the final revision. Anybody use Microsoft Windows? What version are you on? 8? 9? Yeah, okay. Vista? They keep reviving it. It keeps coming out with new and better additions. You iPhone users, OS 8, you know, they're continually bringing out new additions. They continue to improve it. This is the final edition. Nothing can be added to it. Jesus perfects our faith. It's complete. Now, right now, we're in the middle of things. I know we are justified by Jesus. But life is an adventure. Jesus shows us how to live that life. And we might sit back and go, well, yeah, he's Jesus. He's the Son of God. He can walk on water. He can do all these things. I can't. But Jesus went first, and now he comes back and is our perfecter. All right, I think we're past time. All right. Thank you so much for being patient. Let's take a 10-minute break. If you're interested, I hope that you'll come back and we'll continue our study at the top of the hour. God bless.